Welcome to Blog Talk Radio in high fidelity.
Soulvox Radio presents Evolve with your host, Robin White Turtle Disney.
Hi, welcome to the show. This is Robin White Turtle Disney, and the show is Evolve. My special guest today is Todd E. Pressman, PhD, who is a licensed psychotherapist as well as an international lecturer and workshop leader. He's been widely recognized for his work with the Course in Miracles and transpersonal breathwork. His book, Radical Joy, Awakening Your Potential for True Fulfillment, has received high acclaim. He has traveled the world to study the great wisdom teachings, and he spent time with a Zen master in Kyoto and a Jain family, and he's been involved with Zoroastrian high priest outside fire temples in Bombay and in Sri Lanka doing other kinds of ceremonies. He works with, his education includes an internship in Gestalt therapy at the Esalen Institute under Stanislav Grof, who was involved with the Spiritual Emergency Network. He works with his wife at Pressman & Associates at Logos Wellness, and he runs the Center for Management Excellence, which is a center for business. His work is a model based on Michelangelo's ideal that you release the statue from the stone and the high spiritual self from the overlays of imposed identity into the discovery of true freedom, joy, and fulfillment. Todd, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Robin. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So you're coming out to do a California tour because you're on the East Coast, and you're going to be in a couple of different places, and we'll talk about that in just a second. I want to talk also about your book, because you've got this great produced about awakening your potential for true fulfillment. It's called Radical Joy. But you're going to be doing programs all over the place, it looks like. One at Intrinsic Wellness, or Intrinsic Elements, is that correct?
Yes.
IntrinsicElements.com, and that's going to be on Thursday, May 18th from 6 to 8 p.m. There is a small fee for that. You can check their website, IntrinsicElements.com. And then you're going to be at East West Bookshop, which is my base, and you're going to be presenting Radical Joy, Awakening Your Potential for True Fulfillment. So you'll be presenting on your book, is that right?
Yes, the principles of the book and applying them to the particular circumstances that people bring that night.
Right. So that's Friday, May 19th at 7:30. It's free, but you need to call and reserve your seat. And Saturday, May 20th from 1 to 7 p.m., you'll be doing a workshop. So let's jump right in and talk about what your book is about and what your presentation is going to be offering, because I imagine you'll be doing something similar in Modesto at Intrinsic Elements. Is that right?
Yes, it is, in fact. So I gave it that name, that fun name, Radical Joy, because I have always been devoted to releasing people from their fixations that cause them pain or suffering into the true joy that is our natural inheritance. It's mm-hmm. our natural state, and you can see that anytime a crisis comes forth and people have to put aside their petty differences, and they always come together, and there's always a feeling of connection and union and love, if you will, that comes from that. So I did, as you said, travel around the world studying with some pretty wonderful figures to learn their secrets for finding joy and mm-hmm. transforming pain and fear into joy. And eventually I developed this program out of it.
That's fantastic. So in Radical Joy, you're outlining like the process for people to move into their joy. And is this releasing like conditioning or fears and belief systems? Is that
what? Yes, actually, I think your work as an intuitive is showing. That's absolutely right. My understanding of what creates a personality, and personality might be equated with ego, the part of us that gets us tripped up in life, is that we buy into fear at a very young age, And then we build some defenses around it. And the defenses are designed to protect us from the fear, but they actually trap us into fear. Mm-hmm. We're having to stand vigil against the fear, and now we're always filling our minds with the thing we're so afraid of while we're making sure that it doesn't come to pass. So we're never free, back to our original state of innocence and joy. Mm-hmm. And the program is two parts, really. I think insight and action are the components for any real path for healing and growth. So the first part is insight, fully, deeply, and profoundly understanding the nature of how we buy into fear and how we build these defenses. And the second part is taking the actions, which really, if you look at it, boil down to doing the opposite of what your defenses say to do. If the defenses are designed to protect us from the fear, but they backfire, then you want to do the opposite of them and actually find safe and gentle ways to move into the fear slowly but surely. To discover what? That it doesn't exist, the fear evaporates, and what's left is joy.
Mm-hmm. Well, the fear is really the illusion, and it feels real because it scares us, so we get into this kind of hypervigilant place.
Exactly.
But if we can just relax and see that the fear is the illusion, and what's real, what's true, what lasts over lifetimes is the love, that's what's really true.
Absolutely. I talk about the hypnosis of fear or the hypnotizing effect of fear and the lie of fear. These are the two components of the illusion of it. Uh-huh. And the hypnotizing effect of fear is that it brainwashes us. Mm-hmm. So that, as you just said, we never look past it. We're just looking at the catastrophe that we're imagining is going to happen any moment. Mm-hmm. And we don't do what we would normally do in our rational state of mind, which is to look and what happens next, after the fear passes? Guess what? We survive. Mm-hmm. Often, when we face our fear, we find there was nothing there at all. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite quotes is, "My life was filled with terrible misfortunes, most of which never happened."
I love that.
Well, and then the lie of fear mm-hmm. is that it makes us think that all of the possible things that could go wrong in a certain situation will happen at once. So it's totally overwhelming, and we never get to simply deal with one thing at a time or stay in the moment and say, you know what, I can handle this, mm-hmm. and then I can handle the next thing, and I can handle the next thing. Mm-hmm. And again, once we take that strategy, we often find there's nothing to handle. It's all fine.
Yeah, yeah. And our fear is really a smaller part or younger part of ourselves. Do you find that sometimes that, you know, it's the child that's shaking and fearful and has got terrors, and it's not really the adult part of ourselves that totally knows how to handle things, you know?
Yeah. I just finished giving a tour for mental health professionals on a seminar called Deconstructing Anxiety, where we really pick apart every little aspect of what makes for anxiety. And absolutely, it always starts in early childhood, mm-hmm. sometimes before we have language, so we can't access it that way. But there's a first exposure to fear, according to my work with Stan Grof, it actually starts in the womb during the birth process. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then a first response to that fear, called the chief defense, and this sets up our entire understanding of how life works, mm-hmm. what we're going to meet. We start looking at every situation through the lens of what I call the core fear and the chief defense. And that builds our entire personality from a very young age on. Mm-hmm. We layer defense upon defense upon defense, different strategies for how to resolve that original fear mm-hmm. and any other situation that reminds us of it later on. Mm-hmm. And that is what constitutes our personality or our way of going around in the world to try and handle life situations. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, defenses always backfire, so we're never going to, it's like the Course in Miracles says, seek but do not find. Mm-hmm. We're never going to succeed in that effort until we realize it's backwards. We've got to slowly but safely go into the fear little by little mm-hmm. to discover it doesn't have any power. That's the lie of fear that gets exposed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and don't you find, I don't know, maybe you don't find, but I find that some fears that people have are inherited, like, you know, the old story of, you know, cutting off the end of the ham, you know, my mom always cut off the end of the ham before she put it in the pan. And you go to mom and you say, Mom, why did you do that? And she goes, well, I don't know. My mother always did it. And you go to grandma and grandma says, well, my pan was too short. I had to cut it off. You know, so it's like sometimes we have inherited fears that come from our parents. And they come from our ancestry. Like, these were survival fears that were real 100 years ago. But guess what? They're not real anymore. Like, taking care of the potatoes or whatever, the food issues are.
Well, I think that there's that absolutely truth to that, and that we want to understand it in the context of this core fear chief defense dynamic. Because why is it that some people can respond to the same situation or the same household environment in one way and others in a different way? Somebody sees the mom, looking upset for some reason, and they interpret it as something they did wrong, and that becomes the foundation for their personality. And somebody else says, poor mom's having a bad day, I have to take care of her. Totally different responses.
Right.
And it's again because of the initial exposure to fear and the interpretation we made about what it means to our well-being and how we chose to respond to it.
Yeah.
But to get to your point, I think that does go back to past lives and ancestral memories and things we've brought with us from before this incarnation.
Yeah, as well as our direct inheritance. You know, like, I know my mother was, I'm just a side issue here, my mother was very fearful. And in her construct of fear, I chose not to have her fears. Like, from a very early age, I am not going to be like her. I am not going to do that. So
exactly.
Everything in my life has been like, they're out there with whatever it is I have to do. And way beyond other people's fears, I usually scare the bejabbers out of my sisters who had very more secure jobs. So, you know, what I do is not considered secure, but I've created that for myself. So so sometimes we push against the parent in order to create the new reality for ourselves.
Exactly.
So.
And everybody's response, whether they push against or go with the parent's modeling, or something totally different, totally unrelated. They say, I don't want to have anything to do with that, so I'm going to go live my own life and make up a new reality.
Yeah.
It all is formed around early, early decisions, which again are informed by perhaps past lives and collective unconscious issues and things like that.
Uh-huh.
But it's interesting, as an example, I'm working with a patient or client right now who had a mother who was very socially anxious. And her way, the mother's way of responding was to be very appropriate, very careful, very polite, very nice, always being sure that other people were pleased with her so they wouldn't reject her. Well, my patient said, let me do the same thing, and I'm going to model myself after mom because that's what she needs. She needs that security from everybody else, making her feel safe. And she's so important to me, I better do that for her too, or else I'll lose her, right?
Mm.
So two different interpretations to the same situation.
Yeah, I really like that because it's so true in families that there's you can have the same parents and totally different radical experiences of how you feel about them or how you react to them or respond to them. So,
right.
Yeah. So it sounds like by examining a lot of these fears that you see and witness in people, you've come to develop this Radical Joy program. Is that an interpretation that I should be making, that you're trying to get people to their joy? So tell
Absolutely.
Me, how did that all develop? Because, you know, having a program, you know, implies that you've been working with this a long time.
Sure.
And so... Tell us a little bit. How did that develop for you?
Well, I suppose I should go back to when I was about 12 or 13 years old, and I had a profound kind of confrontation with fear where I was just feeling the normal stirrings of an adolescent, right?
Yeah.
With all those hormonal changes and starting to ask questions like, why are we here? What's the meaning of life? But it hit me very hard. And I went to my parents, who had always been able to resolve whatever was wrong, because they were very loving parents. And for the first time in my life, they just looked at me with loving faces. I imagine they were saying, isn't that sweet? Todd's going through his adolescence. But I needed some answers. And I went back to my room quite distraught, because for the first time I couldn't get answers from my parents and I felt lost. And I had, I think as I look back on it, it was a spiritual awakening, because I really saw that who we are in our usual definition of being an ego and a body and this little lifetime isn't all there is. And I was quite challenged with the exposure to infinity. Mm-hmm. I immediately started writing down my thoughts, which I couldn't get out successfully to my parents, and that brought a profound relief. So I built my chief defense at that moment, saying, I'm going to figure out intellectually what's going to solve this problem. And then I thought, well, I'll write a great book, and I'll give it to everybody, and that'll help them too. And off and running I went. But it was the beginning of a process of understanding why and looking at, you know, what's the fear underneath this problem? Why am I upset right now? And mm-hmm. I did start to understand, and later it was confirmed with my very intensive studies with A Course in Miracles, that fear was at the root of every problem we have. Mm-hmm. And if we ask ourselves why in a serial way, like, why is that upsetting to me? Okay, I have an answer for that. And then go one level deeper. But why is that upsetting to me? And you get your answer to that. Mm-hmm. You keep going down and down and down, and you find what I call the core fear, the root fear that traces back to some early childhood experience. And sometimes we know what that is, sometimes we don't, but that doesn't matter. We get a deep and powerful insight into what's operating the machinery, like the man behind the curtain at the Wizard of Oz,
right. That's
making us tick. And that is a process that is sort of the cornerstone of the Radical Joy Method for finding what your core fear is. Then we understand what your chief defense is on top of that. What are the things I do, like historically my personality is oriented to do, to try and take care of that fear in life? And look at how that's backfiring. Mm-hmm. Then you do the opposite of the chief defense, and you start to get some freedom, because you see that what you were so afraid of back then, or what you made up back then is scary, isn't so. Mm-hmm. And then you can reinvent your life from there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I had this framework from an early age. I, you know, was raised by a father who was a psychoanalyst and a mother who was a social worker, so I really didn't stand a chance.
Yeah, you were kind of bred for this world.
Yeah. What's that?
And that you were kind of bred for this world that you're in.
Yeah.
Like the psychotherapy.
Well, I think I chose my parents accordingly.
Yes, absolutely. And then you did world travels. Yeah.
Right.
So when we come back, I want to talk more about that, because you've been with all kinds of really interesting people. And I'd like to talk about your travels a little bit. And we'll go from there, okay? So I'm with Dr. Todd Pressman, who's a licensed psychotherapist as well as an international lecturer and workshop leader. He's written the book Radical Joy, Awakening Your Potential for True Fulfillment. He's going to be doing a West Coast tour, and he'll be at a couple of different places, Intrinsic Elements, and there's information on their website, intrinsicelements.com, and he'll be at East West Bookshop in Mountain View in May 19th and 20th. So we'll be right back.
Evolve, nurturing the new in consciousness, the arts, and culture, with your host, Robin White Turtle Lisney. Evolve brings you people and ideas on the cutting edge of change, opening the shells of the past to move our culture into the now. We are all in great need of sustainable ideas for change. Evolve brings you the wise, the foolish, and the heart-based to help us meet the challenges of our times. Join us the third Thursday of the month at 2 p.m. Pacific Time for Evolve.
Hi, this is your host for Evolve, Robin Whiteturtle-Lisney, and I wanted to share with you a few of the other things that I do in the world beside the radio show. In addition, I'm an energy medicine practitioner in the Bay Area and across the country by phone, and I work through East West Bookshop in Mountain View, California, so you can always find me there on Fridays. In addition, I have 5 books. 4 of them are nonfiction, and 1 is a fiction book that's actually based on facts, called Poems for the Lost Deer. The other books are Heart Path, Heart Path Handbook, and prior to that, Sacred Living and Dancing Up the Moon. My more recent books, Heart Path and Heart Path Handbook, teach people self-love, and this is the foundation of my practice, that love does heal all things. You can find out more about my work on my website, www.thecenterforthesoul.com, and you can also check out the books on www.bluebonebooks.com. And now we'll go back to the show. Hi, I'm Robin Whiteturtle-Lisney. The show is Evolve, and I'm with Dr. Todd Pressman, who's a licensed psychotherapist, psychologist, and international lecturer and workshop leader. He's widely recognized for his work with A Course in Miracles and transpersonal breath work. He's worked with Stan Grof and a number of teachers, Zen masters, and so on, and we're going to talk about that right now. So welcome back, Todd. And
thank you.
Yeah, so let's talk about that world travel. You did a lot of it, it seems like.
Yeah, I did. I was very fortunate that way.
Mm-hmm. So now tell us about, it says in your bio that in 1982 you spent time with a Zen master. So tell us about that. Yeah, I'm sure my audience will be fascinated.
Sure. Well, we were in Kyoto, Japan, and I was traveling with a professor, actually, from the States, who had a teacher who was the master of this particular monastery. It's a very famous monastery with the rock garden that people have seen pictures of, no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And the rock garden was exquisite. Definitely support for meditation and accelerating one's path. And we witnessed a tea ceremony in the Zen tradition. Really came to appreciate how every subtlest movement and gesture was a source of meditation and vehicle for getting into the present moment. And we had some very profound teachings as well from the master. And that Zen has become, along with A Course in Miracles and maybe psychodynamic therapy, my biggest influence in terms of developing the Radical Joy program and the work I do with clients and so forth.
Oh, fascinating. It's fascinating. And then you were also, you stayed with a family, a Jain family. Was that in India?
Yes, it was in Mumbai, then called Bombay. And we were invited for a homestay, and this was a lovely family. I first met the daughter, who was an adult at that point, through a dance performance, a traditional Indian dance performance that she had performed to the accompaniment of a sitar. And then she invited us to stay at her home with her parents. They were a Brahmin family, so they were upper class, which meant they had money, and not too many other people in India did besides the Brahmin class. But they were Jains, J-A-I-N, which is a religion, a part of Hinduism, that's very, very devoted to the sanctity of all life. And they took me to their temple, where I saw people very carefully and lovingly sweeping away some cobwebs in the rafters so that they wouldn't disturb the spiders, but they needed a clean temple at the same time. And similarly, they would walk out front of the temple and very carefully sweep. This was the more devout Jainists, I learned, for sweep the sidewalk in front of them before they would take a step, so they would make sure not to step on any bugs. And this family, I had heard that this was true, but I saw it with my own eyes. They would put out sugar for the ants in the kitchen every night to take care of the ants. Why shouldn't they have food as well? So it was just a beautiful experience of bhakti yoga, the devotional path of love for all creatures.
Fascinating. Okay, so tell us more about the travels that that you went on, because it seems like it's very, a very big impression for you of what you learned.
Yeah, well, it was simply because I was very young at the time and just starting out on my path of trying to understand what makes for these expanded states of consciousness that I was so fascinated by. And I got quite an eyeful, I would say, when I went to both Sri Lanka and Bali, and I saw in Sri Lanka authentic fire walking. It's not what you see at a Tony Robbins workshop. This was a sacred tradition passed down only from father to son, I'm afraid they were sexist in that regard, through the generations, and a very secret book that no one else was allowed to see. And the firewalkers would train their entire lives to be able to perform this ceremony, which would bring great blessing upon the community. And, you know, this was before people really were doing firewalking workshops in the States. So I was thrilled to go. It was really like something out of a romantic novel. Go deep into the jungle of Sri Lanka and see this fire pit and hear the drums, and the incense was going, and this person was dancing with what he called devil's teeth, and I understood that that was a way of sort of identifying with that which he was afraid of, so that he could embrace his fear and master it in that regard. And there was a baton with fire on either end that he was holding in his mouth, and these devil's teeth, and doing a wild trance dance to the accompaniment of the drums. And then, you know, for anybody who says that they walk quickly over the stones, he took a big jump and landed solidly inside the fire pit and stood there for a good 5 seconds before he resumed the trance dance.
Wow.
It was quite remarkable, yeah. And I befriended him afterwards, and through his very broken English and some hand gestures, I was able to receive this story that I just transmitted to you. And then quickly in Bali, it was quite an amazing experience. We had hired a driver, and he was taking us from one part of the island to another, and suddenly he gets very excited because he sees up ahead a group of people on the side of the road, again, in the middle of nowhere, the jungle on either side. And he said, "I've only seen this twice in my life," and he had lived in on the island his whole life. There was a fakir ceremony where the Tamils were making sacrifice to their gods. And again, getting into a deep trance, and it sounds gruesome, but for me it's absolutely fascinating. They had offered, sort of like the Sundance you were telling me about during the break, to offer flesh. That wasn't their description, but they would have big hooks, metal hooks, dug into their back while in a trance state. And the hooks were attached to ropes, and they would spin around in a circle while, you know, praying to their gods. The remarkable thing was there was no blood, and there was no sign of pain. They were just in a trance. And I have a picture that's from 5 feet away showing these hooks in their back with no blood coming out.
Wow.
And again, a very tranquil look on their face.
Wow.
So these things really taught me about the potential of consciousness to go far beyond what most of us have been raised to think is possible, and I wanted to know those secrets.
Well, I witnessed some of that in Sundance, you know, the piercing, they do piercing, and there is bloodletting, but it's part of the recognition that what we own actually is our bodies, and we can offer that in whatever way we want to. So not all people do piercing. It's totally, like, voluntary. There's no coercion at all. In fact, if it's done in that way at all, it's not considered legitimate. So It sounds very similar. Sounds like a similar process. Yeah. Fascinating. Yeah. Wow. Well, so I can see how all of this has informed you in your work, because you're getting to the place where, like, you witnessed radical joy in their travels. And then how do you synthesize all that and get it into your program? You know, that's the struggle I've had as well. You know, how do you translate something from an indigenous culture into Western understanding? Because there's really no context for it.
So. Well, again, I think that with the base that the Course in Miracles gave me, that every problem we have, without exception, is reducible to a fear that we bought into, which is an illusion. It's not truly binding. Is a nice way to understand universally, you know, what creates this human condition where we suffer and experience limitation and forget about our expanded potentials. And it is fear. Actually, it's an interesting point in the Radical Joy program. What limits our expanded potentials and locks us in, seems to lock us into this, you know, very materialistic existence, is our defenses against fear. Because defenses say, I will see things this way, and I will not see more. So it puts blinders on us that limit our ability to see what we used to see and know what we used to know. So as we remove the defense or do the opposite of the defense, move gently but surely into our fears and discover they don't have the potential to hurt us, our expanded possibilities open up naturally. You don't have to do anything special. Again, the Course says your job is not to seek for love, but merely to seek and find all of the barriers you have placed within yourself against it. And those barriers are our fears and defenses. Just remove them, and our natural birthright as higher beings, if you will, is inevitable.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Well, you've done a lot of the studying that you've done as a therapist with Stan Grof. Talk about that a little, because the breath work is a very powerful tool to break through our fears, and I'm sure with Stan's influence you've discovered that, or you've experienced that yourself. So talk a little bit about your work with Stan.
Well, again, I was very, very lucky to be able to train with him for 10 weeks at Esalen Institute at one period, and then several other times for shorter periods later. My father, as I mentioned, was quite a remarkable man. He was a psychoanalyst who was in the early days of psychoanalysis. Some of his teachers were actually students of Sigmund Freud, but then to go from there to the, you know, farthest reaches of consciousness exploration like he did, he was wonderful. And he opened some terrific doors for me, including with Stan Grof. When I was just a late teenager, Stan and Christina, his wife, came to our house and gave a breath work. This was before people really knew too much who they were, at the beginning of the transpersonal psychology movement. And I had my first experience of breath work there, which was just mind-blowing. I had literally become the consciousness of Shiva and doing this dance on the boat that takes you through eternity. It was quite wonderful. And another time with Stan at Esalen, I found myself, I'm telling all my secrets, your listeners are going to know me too well. I found myself thinking I was done with the experience, but then finding a strange sensation in my neck. And when Stan came over, everybody else had finished, and said, let that come through, I, without any intention, again, it was really an expanded or altered state of consciousness where I was barely present as a rational consciousness to observe this, I started doing this trance dance, he called it. He said it looked a bit Balinese, that had me sort of eating up all the space in the room, and I was just conscious enough to say, I wonder if I could do that move again, this very complicated move where I jumped up and landed on my shoulder and did this roll. And then I did it two more times. It was not under my voluntary control. So yeah, I had some wonderful experiences with that tool. And as interesting as those stories might be, they don't necessarily speak to the therapeutic potential of it. But that's where the power of this tool comes in. And I did my dissertation for my doctorate program on Stan Grof's holotropic breathwork technique and its therapeutic potential for psychological and spiritual growth. So I am a big fan, and it's been an important part of my work for helping clients to realize their potential as well.
Mm-hmm. Wow, yeah. Well, that's fantastic, because he does take you out of the logical mind, and you can't not get into the expanded perception of all that we can be. So I totally understand. I've been through some breath work, not with Stan, but with other people that have been students of his, been through some breath work experiences. So, oh, that's fantastic. Well,
yeah.
I am imagining your work as a therapist has, you know, brought you through patients and clients that are really up against a lot of very serious fears for them, you know, like paranoia, schizophrenia. Can you talk a little bit about your work with patients and how maybe there's some breakthrough for them or what you've
sure.
witnessed?
It's not necessarily the case that everybody that comes through the door is working with some kind of serious, quote, pathology, because as A Course in Miracles indicates, and as we've already discussed, fear is endemic in the human condition. Nobody who's born here, except perhaps an avatar who chose to come just to teach, escapes fear. And whatever the circumstance, you don't necessarily need a traditional diagnosis. Sometimes it's helpful to understand patterns that you can look for and save a lot of time. But to really understand the fear and how to work that through with these techniques, which are in the Radical Joy program, that I think are extremely helpful because they're fast and they're reliable.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's not a lot of really reliable work in traditional psychotherapy for dealing with anxiety, if we're talking about fear or depression or anything else, because they're all rooted in fear. But to demonstrate how patient once who did have psychosis, and this was at a time when I worked for just a summer in a psychiatric hospital, so he was on the locked unit, and he was psychotic. He was very delusional and not grounded in reality. But as we did our work together, I came to understand that his fear was that, you know, he had been terribly abused as a kid. And he just wanted everybody to leave him alone. And he actually found a good way to do that by getting locked up in a psych hospital. However, there came a time when he wanted to get out. And don't you know that he was able to turn on his sanity at will, because he needed to look like he was ready for discharge. And he went up in front of the assessors, and he looked normal as everything. He was just totally like you or me. And he got himself out. Luckily, I got to help him understand that wonderful, let's say, expanded state of consciousness. So he could use it on purpose and not have to come from fear and defense. But another important story, again, this woman had some pretty severe pathology, if you want to use that language. She had multiple personalities, and she had over 70 of them.
Oh, my heavens.
She was also a Course in Miracles student and really devoted to her personal growth. So we did our work, which was in a way kind of easy, because each personality, or altar as they're called, represented a specific fear and defense. And so I would ask that personality to come through, and after a while, first we used some hypnosis to do it, but after a while she could just call it forth and go into a hypnotic state herself. And we would understand what the fear of that particular personality was. For instance, the first one was called Four, because she was 4 years old when it happened. And this was her first experience of dissociating into another personality. She saw a picture on the wall while she, again, was being terribly abused. And she willed herself into that picture. It was a picture of a guardian angel. hovering over two children, a boy and a girl. She had a brother, so she was the girl and her brother was the boy. And she put herself into that picture and made it real for herself so that she could escape the abuses. Once we understood that that's what she was defending against and escaping from, I helped her feel my strength and the security of the situation to slowly but surely invade that anxiety and discover it no longer had any potential to hurt her. Mm-hmm. And that personality got integrated. Mm-hmm. One by one, we went through not 72 personalities, because after a while, they started joining of their own accord when she was getting close to full integration. But she had a complete recovery.
Wow.
And she said, let's write a book together. You tell the story from your side, and I'll tell it from my side. And today that book is a reality called The Bicycle Repair Shop, which is based on a dream she had about how I could repair any bicycle, no matter how broken.
Well, it is amazing to watch that happen when people integrate, and I really commend your work, because with that many personalities, you know, that who's in charge, you know, who's the boss in there, you know, that you have to find that core being. So
yeah,
that's fascinating. Yeah, so we're going to take a little break and come right back. I'm with Dr. Todd Pressman, who's a licensed psychotherapist, an international lecturer and workshop leader. He's written a book called Radical Joy, Awakening Your Potential for True Fulfillment. And we'll be right back. This is Robin White Turtle listening, and the show is Evolve.
Evolve, nurturing the new in consciousness, the arts, and culture, with your host, Robin White Turtle Lisney. Evolve brings you people and ideas on the cutting edge of change, opening the shells of the past to move our culture into the now. We are all in great need of sustainable ideas for change. Evolve brings you the wise, the foolish, and the heart-based to help us meet the challenges of our times. Join us the third Thursday of the month at 2 p.m. Pacific Time for Evolve.
Hi, we're back. This is Robin White Turtle listening. The show is Evolve, and I'm with Dr. Todd Pressman, who's a psychotherapist and an international lecturer and workshop leader. And we've been talking about split personalities or schizophrenic personalities, and you were talking to me at the break a little bit about what you experienced that's in the book that you had, The Bicycle Shop. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, The Bicycle Repair Shop, a true story of recovery from multiple personality disorder as told by patient and therapist. That's the full title.
Uh-huh.
And this was, as I said before the break, a patient who was very devoted to her spiritual growth. And again, that made it easier in the sense that she understood from her work with A Course in Miracles that it was important to face fear, and she developed enough of a trust in me over time that she could really go into whatever horror is laid in her unconscious. But you mentioned that it might be difficult to find out who's the boss, and it made me think of one of her personalities who was actually called the boss.
Oh, really?
And it was fascinating because he was like a classic Chicago mob boss. And his role, every personality again served a particular defensive role, was to keep the little ones, as she called them, in line. The little ones were the younger personalities who were all starved for love and safety and affection. And they would clamor for attention even when we were in therapy, because if I was talking to one of them, all the others would try and scramble for some time with me, and he had to keep them in line, so that was his role. But she literally changed her physiology when the boss came out.
Mm-hmm.
And this is noted in work with multiple personalities. Their eye color can change, their diabetic condition can change, and so forth. I saw a man come over her with a total change it wasn't literally, I don't think you could measure a change in the jaw structure, but it looked like the way she was holding her mouth was just different. And at one point, this is why I wanted to tell the story, he, the boss, and I, it was tough, but I had to ally with him and become friends and in order to convince him that it was safe to let go of his controlling role. And he confided in me like a whisper. He said, "I'm working on getting rid of these." And he pointed to my patient's breasts because it was like one evidence of the reality that was discrepant with her internal experience, that he was a he, but that didn't work. So he said, "I'm working on getting rid of them." It was fascinating, yeah.
Oh, dear.
And the other story that came to mind was about who was the boss. She had an experience of being guided by an inner voice before she met me. And true to form, after she integrated all these personalities, we didn't know. Was he one of the personalities? In fact, it turned out he was not. He was an authentic, individuated, if you will, consciousness that was from a very high source. And after her work with me, he did return, and she started giving spiritual counseling sessions with channeling from him that was just extraordinary. I experienced it myself. But, you know, in terms of who's boss, she integrated all these other personalities into one personality, and she didn't integrate that one because he was not part of her in that strict sense of the word.
Ah, so he was a spirit that she actually embodied.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yep.
That's so fascinating. I just this morning did a session with someone. I do house clearing, so I clear spirits from houses. And she had a spirit in the house, the person that I worked with, had a spirit in the house who was trying to teach her that she shouldn't be afraid of her intuition. And it had been doing this for lifetimes. So we went all the way back to the first lifetime in order to understand what her terror was of the feminine. And she's a woman, she functions as a woman, but her masculine personality or logical mind is so dominant that it doesn't allow the feminine intuition to come up. And she's a natural medium. So it's really hard for her to keep suppressing that. She's using a lot of energy for it.
Right.
This separate spirit was in the house saying, "You need to let go of this." And she said, "Well, I'll let go of it if you stop turning my television on and off." So we had to make some compromises. But it's fascinating that she actually embodied a spirit that was actually benevolent and there to help her. In the form of this mob boss.
Right.
Which is kind of the opposite. So
right.
Fascinating. So what are the biggest fears that you see, Todd, that most people have? Can they kind of be boiled down to like fear of this or fear of that, or are they all over the place?
It's a great question. An important part of the Radical Joy method is, again, to find your core fear, and I hinted at the process for that. It's a matter of asking a series of questions. Why is that upsetting to me? Or what am I afraid will happen next? Or what am I afraid I will miss or lose? Each of which gets you down closer to the core fear underneath the initial problem. And once you find it, the core fear at the root of all your problems, that original interpretation you made up as a child about how life works when fear threatens us, you realize this explains everything, and you found what's really, like I call them, a universal theme of loss. There are five core fears that represent these universal themes of loss that all of us buy into. Many, many different forms of them, but if you break them down, they really boil down into one of these five categories. And they are, nobody's going to be surprised at the first one, fear of abandonment, which is the fear of losing love. Fear of losing identity, like who am I, you know, do I matter, do I have a sense of who I am that makes a difference in the world. Next is fear of losing your meaning. I don't have any reason for being here that makes a contribution. Fear of losing your purpose, which is different from meaning, because purpose is about expressing yourself. What are your unique talents and gifts? that you need to express in order to feel like your life is fulfilled. The fear of losing that is one of the real common ones we see. And the last one is the fear of death, of course, which includes, in my understanding, the fear of pain and sickness, because pain and sickness actually go to the fear of death. Mm-hmm. So those are the five core fears. And again, there are probably an infinite number of spin-offs of each of those. But when you go through the process for finding your core fear, I call it digging for gold, mm-hmm. You'll come down to one of these five. It may be worded differently. You may find a different language more helpful for understanding it than another, but they do boil down into one of those five.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Well, that helps people, you know, recognize that there are universals here, that we're all going through challenges, and you know, they're inherent in being in the earth, because survival has been an issue for after century. So they tend to come down to what is our survival. A fear of death is a survival mechanism, you know.
But so is fear of losing identity, right?
Right.
And fear of losing love, because without love, there's no identity and no purpose and no meaning.
Yeah.
And death threatens to take us away from our loved ones and source of love. So they all fit together in that respect. It's interesting you said we know that by this taxonomy, this set of categories, that we're not alone. Well, one of the fears that we all seem to have, and I would call this the fear of losing your identity, is that I'm the only one struggling with this, right? I'm the only one struggling with an ego. Well, isn't it interesting? Every ego is saying that I'm the only one. So once we realize our connection to everybody else, that's just something the ego does when it works with the concept of identity, rather than losing itself into the concept of oneness or the experience of oneness.
Yeah, fascinating, fascinating. Well, along with fears, we also have beliefs about ourselves. So do you run into belief systems that are a challenge as well as the fears? Or do you work primarily with fears, or like belief systems, you know, they invade us from, like, sometimes when there's a challenge in childhood, there's also a belief that we have about ourselves, that I can't do this or I can't do that. Or...
Yeah, well, I think the beliefs are, it's a different word for defenses. So we adopt these beliefs as ways to defend against fears.
Right.
If we say, I can't do this, or I'm no good, or have low self-esteem, that's a belief system that's actually designed to protect us from getting our hopes up that we can do such and such. Mm-hmm. We don't want to get our hopes up because we'll be disappointed and we'll be exposed to the same problem we were exposed to in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So I really think that this model, again, really it's borrowed from A Course in Miracles and elaborated with certain concepts from psychology, is so helpful, because when you reduce everything to a core fear, and then what are the particular defenses we've bought into to respond to that fear in our unique way, in a unique way that actually builds our personality, you can understand everything about who you are, why you do what you do, and what you've done that has gotten you into trouble, and how to reverse that.
Mm-hmm. And so how do people feel differently once they release these things? What happens, you know, like I'd like to give them a little impetus to actually do the work, because this is the work that we all have to do, whether we do it in this lifetime or another one. So tell us a little bit about what you see with people once they release these fears and judgments, belief systems.
You know, not everybody that comes to me is interested in spirituality or believes in it even. Again, that's a nice example of how when we don't believe in spirituality, and I hope it doesn't sound like I'm imposing a dogma, but it comes from experience that when you release defenses and fears dissolve, you do open up to a higher awareness. It's just spontaneous, and you know that it's a more accurate description of reality. But to get back to your question, some people just come because they're in pain, and they want to have freedom from pain. So that's a pretty rewarding motivation right there.
Right.
Once you get rid of the fear that's causing the pain, you're a much happier person.
Mm-hmm.
Again, radical joy. But it does go further than that, because as we let go of these defenses, which are as we said, like blinders on our understanding of what's possible. We expand our sense of potential and our possibilities for, let's say, psychic potentials or clairvoyant potentials or energy healing potentials. All of these things come naturally. Mm-hmm. And I say, if you really understand your core fear and work through your chief defense so that the fear dissolves and you know yourself to be part of the oneness, not separated from it, part of God, if you want to use that language, then there is no more limitation of any sort. You adopt the potentials of your godly nature. Right. Nothing limits you anymore. Limitation is only the result of defenses that put up limits around who we think we are, thinking we do that because we think it's going to protect or defend us against something that's not really even threatening in the first place. Mm-hmm. So the sky's the limit, literally, when it comes to what this work can do and the kind of joy that it can open up for us.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So you work with people and you work with corporations too. So does this also apply to the body of a corporation, or the spirit of a corporation, or the culture of a corporation, if you will?
Absolutely.
Talk to us about how that works.
What's often called the culture of a corporation, and it's a good word because it describes the culture. We think of culture as something that is a characteristic of society and its flavors and its preferences and its beliefs and its values. But isn't that the same as a personality?
Mm-hmm.
So the society or the business is like a group person that has a distinct personality. And as we've been saying on this show, personality is composed of the core fear and the chief defense. And I like to use the analogy, if you look at the culture of a society of America, we actually have a chief in charge of the defense, and that's why he or she is there, he so far, hopefully a she soon, to create enough of a structure or protective system against the fears that come from bouncing up against each other in our society. It's, you know, people who buy into egos are going to bump up against each other, and they're going to attack or defend, a la the Course in Miracles. And we think that we need a governmental structure to, or a CEO in a business, to manage all of that in the way of defenses and protections. If we were to buy into a society or a value system and a society based on the value system where we realize we are one, we are together in this endeavor, and that your good is my good, then we don't need these imposed structures of defense and threats of more fear, like a military or a police force or what have you, to keep ourselves in line. We naturally want to cooperate because we understand that's how things actually work better. The CEO is, again, the counterpart to the president of a country. But he or she is full of their own personality, right? So when I go into corporations, this is exactly the work we do, either at the upper management, middle management, or frontline worker level, to help them see this is the stuff that's been getting them into trouble. And if they really want success in their job, if they want pride of ownership, if they want to see an improvement even in the bottom line, it's about working together, and that means getting rid of these defensive blocks between us.
Mm-hmm.
There's a beautiful story I like to give of a scene in hell where everybody is seated in front of a banquet table filled with the most gorgeous foods you can imagine. The only problem is their forks are longer than their arms, so they can't get the food in their mouths. That's what makes it hell.
Uh-huh.
And the scene from heaven is the same banquet table, the same gorgeous food, the same forks, but this time everybody is feeding each other.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful, wonderful. Well, it's been just such a pleasure talking to you, and I'd like to ask if there's anything else that you would like to share with our audience in any level of the work that you're doing, this very important work of radical joy and helping people wake to their full potential.
Thank you for asking. I'd like to pick up on your good question earlier. What's the reward for people to face their fears. It sounds unpleasant, right? Mm-hmm. At least. But I can't emphasize strongly enough, and the more I go forward with this radical joy method, the more impressed I am with its power to completely uproot the very source of what causes our suffering in life, mm-hmm. and genuinely transform it or dissolve it so that there is no more belief. You see it as an illusion that has no power to stop you. And then the way is clear toward creating the reality that you want, toward accessing our higher potentials, to knowing, in fact, that we are one with the divine. And nothing can stop us mm-hmm. from experiencing that when we see through the limitations or illusions of our fears. Mm-hmm. So the path is good and nothing in the way.
Right, right. And it's such an important part of understanding why we're here, because we're not here just to keep playing out our fears. We're here to release them so we can be all that we can be in this life. So
exactly.
Yeah. So thank you so much.
That.
Yeah. So I've been talking to Dr. Todd Pressman. He's a licensed psychologist and international lecturer and workshop leader. He's going to be in California doing a couple of programs. One is at the Intrinsic Elements, intrinsicelements.com in Modesto, and at East West Bookshop in Mountain View. The Intrinsic Elements is on the 18th from 6 to 8 p.m., and Radical Joy, Awakening Your Potential for True Fulfillment will be Friday, May 19th, 7:30, and then a workshop on the 20th from 1 to 7. You can look at the eastwestbookshop.com website for that information. So thank you so much, Dr. Pressman. It's been a delight to have you on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Robin.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed the show. This is Deb Caracella. Please join us next time for Evolve with Robin White Turtle Lisney, Thursday afternoon at 2 p.m.